This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Pranav Rajwakar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast.
Listeners, welcome to season two.
Adrielle, I think I speak for the both of us when I say we have missed this.
Totally. I mean, you and I get to chat with some of the leading AI health entrepreneurs, investors, scientists. So the podcast is a real treat.
A treat it is. We're coming back to season two and a few things have changed. The weather, for one.
That's right. We're in new phases of life. Pranav has recently moved to Boston, starting as an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School in biomedical informatics. How badass is that? And I have moved to New York City, where I'm working on health AI at Apple.
You can send us code and boot recommendations for the winter to your listeners.
And so this new phase of our life also corresponds to a new phase of our podcast.
And let's get to it. Welcome to episode one of season two.
Let's do it. So today we'll be talking to Vivian Lee, president of health platforms at Verily, a subsidiary of Alphabet focused on life sciences and healthcare. And we'll focus on how the healthcare system currently functions financially and what's being done to reform it. So let's start by giving some background on different reimbursement structures and how they influence the behavior of different players in the healthcare space.
Okay. So as I understand it, the most common form of healthcare reimbursement in America is fee-for-service. The idea here is that providers, the folks who are providing the healthcare, which could be a doctor, nurse, clinic, hospital, et cetera, provide some form of medical service and are reimbursed by an insurance company or payer for providing that service. And the federal government, through Medicare and Medicaid, is the largest of these payers.
Exactly. And as a result of this model, providers are generally incentivized to provide a large volume of care. So lots of tests, surgeries, et cetera. And they're not paid based on how effective this care actually is in making or keeping patients healthy. And so we've seen overall healthcare costs in America totally skyrocket with little to show for it in improved patient outcomes. A popular alternative to this reimbursement model, though, and the one that we'll be focusing on with Dr. Lee, is a value-based model. And the goal of the value-based model is to instead incentivize providers to keep patients healthy and have them consume fewer healthcare resources.
Okay. So at a super high level, how is this structured?
The common theme across different models is that providers share some of the financial risk for providing for a patient. So if they're able to care for a patient more cheaply than expected over a period of time, they can profit. And then vice versa, if they end up spending more than expected. It's, of course, difficult to measure quality, but for example, some basic metrics are hospital readmission rates, percentage of high-risk individuals who receive mammograms, and how well blood sugar is controlled among diabetic patients. We'll be talking with Dr. Lee a lot about Medicare Advantage, so let's start there. Medicare Advantage is a Medicare program in which beneficiaries opt into a plan offered by a private insurer rather than being insured directly through the government. Medicare pays that private insurer a fixed capitation payment to care for that patient over a period of time, and then rates the insurer based on the quality of care that it provides.
Okay, and how similar is this to the value-based care we're talking about?
Yeah, so it is kind of similar. The capitation payment that Medicare gives a private insurer is certainly analogous to the kind of payment model we're looking for in value-based care. But technically speaking, value-based care refers to the relationship between the insurer and the provider. And under Medicare Advantage, these private insurers are free to arrange their own contracts with providers however they see fit.
And these private insurers should have an incentive to contract with providers in a way that reduces cost.
Exactly. And CMS has found that Medicare Advantage organizations do have a large number of value-based payment arrangements with the providers that they network with. But it's a complicated landscape, and many providers are still resistant to these models for a whole number of reasons, like fear of reduced pay or concern over quality metrics, insufficient data sharing infrastructure.
Interesting. And so what can be done to push those arrangements away from fee-for-service towards value-based care?
For one thing, on the structural side, there has been a lot of consolidation of payers and providers into single entities. And that's called payer providers or payviders. A payvider is generally formed when a payer acquires a provider network, or a provider develops its own insurance plan, or the two form a joint venture. This model isn't new. So for example, Kaiser Permanente in California and Geisinger Health in Pennsylvania have been operating this way since the 1990s. But recently, it's been growing in popularity, in part because a shared bottom line makes it easier to coordinate value-based care. A few big ones you may have heard of are Humana, Centene, Highmark Health.
And what leverage does the government have to push for value-based care and Medicare Advantage?
So by law, CMS is prohibited from requiring Medicare Advantage organizations to adopt particular price structures with their providers. But they can provide incentives of different kinds for high-value, low-cost care. And one example is the value-based insurance design model. Basically, participating Medicare Advantage organizations can receive additional flexibility to target benefits if they demonstrate a systematic approach to planning care. And CMS now pays providers bonus payments for partaking in riskier payment agreements as a part of Medicare Advantage plans.
That makes sense. But what about everyone who is on traditional fee-for-service Medicare?
Well, CMS has been hard at work here as well. In 2010, the Affordable Care Act established what is now the largest alternative payment model, and that's the Medicare Shared Savings Program, which providers representing about 20% of Medicare beneficiaries now participate in. Under this program, accountable care organizations, or ACOs, which are groups of doctors, hospitals, other healthcare providers, agree to give coordinated care. And then they share in savings that they pass on to Medicare. Medicare recently announced that in 2020, accountable care organizations participating in the Medicare Shared Savings Program and its more recent iterations catered to 12.1 million beneficiaries of traditional Medicare, earned $2.3 billion in performance payments, and saved the program net $1.9 billion.
Okay, so Medicare is projected to cost almost $700 billion in 2021. So $1.9 billion is certainly a start, but we have a long way to go. What did you mean by those more recent iterations?
Yeah, I mean, government programs are never that simple. So the Affordable Care Act directly established the Shared Savings Program, but it also established the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, which is given $10 billion every 10 years to test out a number of different alternative payment models. And in 2021, CMS plans to operate 12 distinct models offering 25 different tracks for providers to choose from. And this involves different payment options and risk arrangements, and a few are direct iterations on the Shared Savings Program.
Seems like there are quite a few ideas out there. What are some criticisms of value-based care, and why is the transition happening so slowly?
So, one reason it's been happening so slowly is that providers are worried about reduced income. And Dr. Lee will talk a bit about how COVID is changing this picture. But there are certainly other concerns as well. Some physicians worry that the consolidation required for effective coordination and tracking of outcomes will empower administrators to even further dictate how they provide care. And the additional administrative and technical burden needed could force them to spend even more time in front of a computer and less time with patients. Value-based care requires a lot of technical overhead.
And why is that?
Well, providers need to be able to easily share patient records to coordinate care, identify candidates for preventative interventions, track patient outcomes across a number of facilities. And so value-based care is especially exciting for tech and AI companies because it aligns provider incentives with the types of data coordination and analysis challenges they're best suited to solve.
Got it. And this is where Dr. Vivian Lee and her work with Verily fits in.
Yes. As a leader in data analytics, software development, and AI, Verily is a great example of a tech company well-positioned to profit off of this value-based model and help make it work. They have a number of different initiatives, and one that we'll be talking about is Onduo, a virtual care model that integrates medical devices, data analytics, and software to personalize digital care intervention programs. It started by helping customers manage type 2 diabetes and has since expanded to cover mental health, hypertension, and much more. They announced a partnership this year with Highmark Health, which is a Medicare Advantage organization and payvider, participating in the value-based insurance design model that we were talking about earlier. And the goal is to further build out Onduo's capability to virtually provide personalized data and actionable insights to customers. Separate from Onduo, but very relevant to our story, is a new partnership that Verily announced last month with the Mayo Clinic to develop a tool for clinical decision support using integrated electronic health records.
That's right. And today we'll be interviewing Dr. Vivian Lee, the president of health platforms at Verily. Before working at Verily, Dr. Lee served as the CEO of University of Utah Health. And before that, she was the chief scientific officer and vice dean for science at NYU Langone Medical Center. Needless to say, she's worn a lot of hats and has deep experience with the healthcare system from a lot of different perspectives. And we're really excited to have her with us today. Vivian, thank you so much for being with us here today.
My pleasure. It's great to be with you.
I really enjoyed reading your book. In your book, you explain the problem with the way medicine is practiced being not so much who's paying, but what we're paying for. And you propose turning the way we receive care completely inside out. I really like the examples you share of how this has been done, how physician practices shift their focus to preventative care, how hospitals learn lessons from manufacturing plants to make them safer, and how healthcare organizations share online how much care costs and how well each physician is caring for the patients. I really enjoyed that. But before we get started with any specific questions there, I'd just love to hear from you in your own words a little bit about your book.
What motivated me to write the book was really this realization after working in healthcare for a long time and then leading a healthcare system and teaching medical students and nursing students and looking at healthcare through their eyes, the realization that what we had fundamentally was this huge behavior change problem. We want people to be healthier. And what does that mean? We need them to exercise more and eat better, you know, change their behaviors. We want to practice more consistent care and lower cost, higher quality care. So we need our physicians and our clinicians and nurses and to maybe change some of their behavior as well. And we need our payers to change their behavior in terms of what they're paying for. And that's hard. It's really a challenging environment to work in to begin with. And then to expect people to change at that level of scale is really hard. And I was really motivated to sort of tell stories from across the country of how people have successfully navigated that change and examples of where that change actually turned out to be more than worth it, that we could create these sort of win-win-win environments if we could all get our minds around what needed to be solved and really work together to solve them. And when I was writing the book, I sort of had this epiphany that it was really fundamentally the business model of healthcare that was broken, this idea of paying in a fee-for-service model. And in thinking about that, I came to the realization that many of the solutions that I could see around the country were also from the business community. And you alluded to that a little bit, Pranav, which is if we are thinking about hospitals as very complex organizations that want to produce better health outputs, and they're a little bit like manufacturing plants, maybe in the 1950s and 60s, that needed to learn how to do more total quality improvement and lean and Six Sigma kind of work, or on the more outpatient ambulatory side, it was more like a service, more like banking and other services where we could learn a lot from those industries about how we work with consumers or patients to co-produce those services and really partner together. And so I wanted to share a lot of those lessons and try to make it written in a not so much of a textbook kind of approach, but more stories, because I think they really stick with people better.
I'd love for you to share maybe one of those stories. You mentioned a lot around opportunities that a lot of people in healthcare agree on in terms of that we waste, we overtreat, make deadly mistakes, practice medicine, and consistently wait until it's too late. Could you maybe pick an example or two of a story that you found particularly illuminating when you were writing this book?
When I talk to people about healthcare who are not in healthcare, oftentimes people will say, well, you know, I don't really have that problem because I have insurance through my employer, so I'm very lucky. And so I know healthcare costs are rising, but it's not really affecting me. And I realized in writing the book and in talking with people that, in fact, actually, we are all paying for the rising costs of healthcare. And in fact, in this country, on average, as you all know, we're spending 2.5-3 times as much per person on healthcare as most other high-income nations. And yet we have the worst outcomes compared to all of them. So we're definitely paying kind of as a population, but individually we're also each paying. And one of my favorite stories was from a physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering who told me the story. And he said, well, you know, healthcare is a lot like when you go out with a group of friends for dinner and you know you're splitting the bill at the end of the night. And you look at the menu and you think, I could order a Caesar salad or, you know, get a burger or something. Or, you know, I could get the surf and turf. And, well, we're splitting the bill, so, you know, I'll get the surf and turf. And, of course, at the end of the night, everybody's ordered the surf and turf and a few extra drinks. And that's really how healthcare works. You know, we think, oh, I'll just go bring my kid to the emergency room, even though it might be able to wait until the morning. And I could probably see the pediatrician, but then I'd have to take time off work. And, you know, and at the end of the day, we are all paying the bill. We complain, oh, the premiums have gone up, you know, 15%. Well, that's our surf and turf.
That's an incredible analogy. I literally had that situation with a group of friends last week. And so that really has hit home.
We've spoken to a lot of entrepreneurs on this show about how to navigate selling a AI for healthcare product in this space. And one concept that comes up often is misaligned incentives. You talk a lot in your book about the incentives currently for insurers, for physicians. Could you talk a little bit about how these incentives are misaligned right now?
I call it the annual $1 trillion tug of war. And what I mean by that is maybe half of all Americans who get their health insurance through their employers, the employers and nowadays the employees as well are contributing a significant amount, put in the money, they pay their premiums up front into their insurance plan. And then throughout the year, the insurance company is supposed to pay out that money to the doctors and nurses and clinics where these individuals get care. And so through the course of the year, hospitals and doctors and nurses are trying to put out as many bills as possible in order to generate revenue. That's their revenue. And of course, the insurance companies are really trying to hold back as much as possible. And so what happens is as the hospitals need to come up with more and more creative ways of billing, they invest in these hundreds of millions of dollars of electronic health record systems that are really giant billing and coding systems in order to figure out how to optimize billing. And insurance companies put up these barriers of prior authorization and denials and, you know, all kinds of restrictions on the way in which they will pay those bills. And back and forth, there's this sort of tug of war. It ends up generating a huge amount of waste in terms of administrative paperwork and burden. I think it contributes a lot to burnout, physician burnout especially. And then when they can't resolve the issues, the bill, often called a surprise bill, falls into the hands of the patients. So the patients are really the ones who suffer the most. And so what you have in this fee-for-service model that is, I think, really at the core of our problem in the U.S. in terms of the business of healthcare is an adversarial relationship between the provider and the person who's supposed to be paying for those services. And neither of them are necessarily fully aligned with what the patient wants. And that's at its core the problem that we face. And so the long fix is really about many of examples of how we can change the business model and have already started to do that across the country in order to restore the alignment. Because that what we really want is the payer, the clinician, and the patient all trying to drive to better health for individuals and for our communities and populations.
So we've had a system that, as you describe several times in the book, rewards action, not better health outcomes. So we're paying for each pill, each echocardiogram, lab test, operation, regardless of whether it makes people healthier. And in some of the newer models, in terms of these payment systems, this is going to change. Could you describe a little more as to the timeline that you expect this change to occur on?
Well, the changes that are happening in terms of the payment models of healthcare, I think may be accelerated with the COVID pandemic. But even before the pandemic, I think we were seeing the most progress on the Medicare side. So in Medicare, which, as you know, is the government program to support seniors, traditionally that program has been fee-for-service. So every time a patient is seen by a clinician, the clinician sends the bill and then they're paid. But starting actually more than a decade ago, Medicare started experimenting with new models, including one that's now called Medicare Advantage. And in the Medicare Advantage model, instead of fee-for-service, instead of paying for every procedure or every visit, the government now pays a medical group, for example, a fixed amount of money to care for one of their patients for the whole year. And so let's say, you know, Mrs. Jones is sort of pretty healthy, maybe that amount is $10,000. You know, it's done statistically, you know, with actuaries and stuff. So based on how fundamentally healthy that individual is. And so let's say they get a fixed amount of money and their job is to keep Mrs. Jones healthy throughout the year for that $10,000. And if she is healthy and just gets her regular visits and checkups and everything's good, and maybe they only end up spending $3,000 or $4,000 on her, then they actually get to keep the $7,000 and they make a profit, which is wonderful. On the other hand, if she's admitted to the hospital, has to go to the emergency room multiple times and end up costing $20,000, then that medical group loses and they have to absorb those costs. So in this modified version of this completely different payment model, it really changes the interests of all of the parties. So the insurance company now no longer has to dispute with the medical group whether they should be spending on this test or that prescription, because presumably the medical group is acting in the interest of trying to keep costs down. They have very clear quality expectations. So they have to keep Mrs. Jones healthy. And Mrs. Jones also, after a year, can decide to move to a different medical group if she's dissatisfied. So there are sort of multiple ways in which the medical groups are expected to meet certain quality and performance standards. And so with these new models, I think there's much stronger alignment between what the patient is interested in, what the provider is interested in, what the payer is interested in. We're already seeing rapid uptake. So I think when I was writing the book, it was around 30% of all Medicare members were in Medicare Advantage programs, and it's projected to hit 50% just within a couple more years. So it's been one of the fastest growing programs in the country. I think we're seeing some of that take hold. And what was so interesting in COVID was that these Medicare Advantage groups, the medical practices that were focused on this kind of business model, were really much more resilient throughout COVID. Because remember, in the old fee-for-service model, if the clinic shut down, those physicians wouldn't be able to capture any revenue. And so there was a period of time when doctors were getting laid off, nurses were getting laid off, whereas these Medicare Advantage groups, they had this steady income. They knew every month how much they were going to get paid from Medicare because it was already worked out in the beginning of the year. And so they were able to use those dollars and actually invest in things like vans to bring services to their patients or to convert their clinics into urgent care facilities so their patients wouldn't have to go to the emergency room if they felt sick. So it proved not only to be a better business model pre-COVID, but also one that's much more resilient.
That's fascinating. Are there efforts right now, either regulatory efforts or even just within hospital systems, to sort of double down then on this sort of incentive system because of the success over the last year and a half during COVID?
Absolutely. We're hearing both from private insurers as well as from bigger health systems who've not been engaged in this kind of a business model or a payment model, a much greater appetite, a much greater willingness to look at this. I mean, so many hospital systems were sort of on the brink of bankruptcy by COVID and, you know, thinking about, okay, maybe taking on some of this financial risk and this sort of new model might be worth it if it can create a more resilient, more sustainable model for us. So I think the COVID pandemic is actually going to accelerate some of this change. And we'll also see that I think these groups are using a lot more digital technologies with those dollars. That's another, you know, advantage of both the model that these groups can make those investments and sort of realize the value of those investments right away. And of course, you know, the pandemic has just accelerated the need for those as well.
I want to ask on that note, one of the ways in which people have thought about getting payment for, let's say, a diagnostic radiology AI system is have CMS reimburse it. So every time that system is used, the hospital would get reimbursed a certain amount. That's the charge of using that particular diagnostic AI tool. Do you feel like there's going to be a change in that model in the future, specifically for AI diagnostic or risk prediction tools?
Well, I'm going to reveal my bias on this front, which is that I really hope so, because I feel like that model of paying every time you use an AI algorithm just reinforces or recapitulates the whole fee-for-service model. And I'll tell you a story of what happened to me during the pandemic that was related in the telehealth space, another use of technology, right, to deliver healthcare. I was calling up a clinician's office for a relative of mine to try to get a COVID antibody test scheduled for them. And, you know, I was just speaking with the administrative assistant, scheduling it and so on. And just as I was about to hang up the phone, she said, oh, and I just wanted to let you know that this will be charged as a telehealth visit. And I said, actually, I didn't say anything. I was speechless. And then she said, just before I hung up, she said, oh, but don't worry, there won't be any co-payment for you. And I remember thinking, if telehealth becomes this fee-for-service, pay every time you text or pay every time you video conference with somebody, it's going to face the same problems that we have in regular healthcare, which is that trillion-dollar tug of war. It's just going to be another chit in that tug of war where clinicians will want to use it. They'll want to use the AI algorithms that you're talking about. They'll want to use telehealth. And the insurance company, what are they going to want to do? Deny it. And so we will have that same misalignment. And I think here we have the opportunity to, let's change the scenario to that Medicare Advantage model that we talked about. Well, in the Medicare Advantage model, and the physicians who have access to AI, let's say image interpretation AI or other AI algorithms, they can make the decision whether it is cost effective for them to use that algorithm to improve the diagnosis or to detect, you know, something on the CAT scan or to do a middle of the night read, let's say when they don't have a radiologist available for whatever reason. And they will use it for the right reason. They'll use it because it's actually driving value. They're not going to use it just because now they can claim another few hundred dollars and bill some more money. And that's what we need in healthcare. That's what we need. We need to show that these new technologies are actually providing benefit to patients. And that's why we should be paying for them, is for that benefit.
Is it surprising, though, that telemedicine and AI are being handled in exactly the same way that every other healthcare service is being handled? Like, would we have expected them to have been handled differently from a billing standpoint?
Well, you wouldn't expect it to be handled differently if it were coming straight out of our existing healthcare system. But this is part of the reason why I came to Verily and left the traditional healthcare delivery systems, which is that when we talk in Verily about what we can do in health platforms for healthcare transformation, we talk about not only can we disrupt in terms of the products, the AI capabilities, the predictive analytics that we're able to do, or the new sensors and devices, but we can disrupt the business model of healthcare. And my team has heard me say this over and over again, which is the real opportunity is to marry both of those. So for example, in our digital health solution on Duo, which is an app with hardware and devices to help people with conditions like type 2 diabetes and hypertension and depression, weight loss, and so on. We offer a wonderful product. It actually really is transformative, having really very, very impressive outcomes in terms of patient engagement and sustained change. not surprising because, you know, they carry this app with them every day as opposed to going to a doctor every 6 months. But also, we really put a stake in the ground in terms of trying to disrupt the business. So we said, you know, instead of billing every time somebody clicks on our app or every download, we only want to get paid for better outcomes. And in our business terms, we say 100% risk. We will go 100% at risk for this. So you only pay us if across all your employee base, the average patient's blood sugar is improved by so much, their HbA1c is reduced by so much, or their blood pressure is reduced by so much if they're hypertensive. We only get paid for that. And we're willing to put our money where our mouth is. And I think that that's the kind of disruption that we would expect from the technology sector or, you know, industries that are outside of traditional healthcare, disruptive in product, but also disruptive in the business model. At least that's what I hope for.
No, I think that's fascinating. And I think Onduo is doing incredible work. And I know you briefly gave an overview, but just for our listeners again, Onduo is a platform that helps people with diabetes or with weight loss, hypertension. And it's sort of a holistic experience, right? It's like there's both a predictive analytics component to it, but you also have a personal relationship through telemedicine with a doctor. And I know that right now you guys are targeting specific use cases, but is there sort of a larger vision that this sort of approach would be able to be helpful for the general population? And is there a vision to sort of expand this to everyone?
Oh, absolutely. So I think a fundamental insight that I had early on in this journey is as clinicians, you know, when we think about people who have diabetes or people who have hypertension, you know, we even call people diabetics or hypertensives, you know, they don't even have a human identity, right? They just have that condition.
Yeah.
But of course, if you flip the perspective and you think about yourself when you wake up in the morning, you certainly don't think of yourself as, oh, somebody who has occasional back pain and a bunion or whatever. Like, I certainly don't think about myself that way. So I think about, you know, what am I going to eat today? How did I sleep last night? I think about, am I going to go to the gym or exercise? You know, I think about my life.
Yeah.
And the ways in which I think our engineers and our user experience researchers and designers and our product managers at Verily think about these products is very much from that consumer perspective, which has been so refreshing to me. So absolutely, at core to the programs that we have now are really these fundamental areas of engagement with people about how are they eating, their diet. Of course, starting with type 2 diabetes, you obviously focus on diet and exercise and medications, but those are really common to everyone. And actually, we stumbled into the weight loss program when we realized that through healthy eating for type 2 diabetes, we were seeing significant amounts of weight loss, which of course isn't surprising when you think about it, but that was really important. The ability to engage with another person who really cares about you is also fundamentally core. It doesn't matter if you have a condition or if you're just sick of being locked up with COVID or whatever the situation is. And so we have both coaches as well as physicians. And so our health coaches, dietitians, you know, there's a group of various kinds of healthcare professionals that interact with people and are able to use some of the AI tools also to supplement some of the insights. So for example, you know, you and I may have a similar meal together and I may eat cornflakes for breakfast and you may eat eggs and toast for breakfast, but we both have coffee and for you, the skim milk works better. And for me, the soy milk works better. These different kind of patterns, the AI algorithms are able to identify and also not only feedback to you and me, but also to the coaches. So the coaches can kind of make really helpful recommendations. In addition to being kind of just supportive and provide good medical advice, they can actually give very personalized advice supported by that AI.
You know, I think one of the unique things about Onduo is that there's a telemedicine component sort of that's maybe not quite as scalable, but there's also this AI component that usually we associate with being incredibly scalable. And I guess maybe putting your MBA hat on for a second, how do you think about that interplay between a product that has parts of it that do scale well and maybe parts of it that are more analog? Does that worry you or is that for you just sort of a necessary component of working within the healthcare system?
Oh, Adriel, that is such an insightful question, but it's a really profound one because so much of what we offer when we come to the table as a technology company, people automatically think about, you know, the scenario of it's just all tech and it's all about the tech. But of course, it's that human connection that makes a difference. And it's the personalization that really makes a difference. So how do we do that at scale? What we are able to do, we don't want to do away with the human touch. But what we can do is almost act as an extender to the humans who are on the other end. So we can act as an extender. For example, some of the interactions can simply be with a chatbot. It doesn't have to be. If you're texting and you're just reporting some things that you've eaten,
right,
I don't necessarily need a human on the other end to say, good job, or maybe that double cheeseburger and fries wasn't the best idea. You know, I mean, I can have a chatbot do that. Or, for example, the AI that can leverage with those insights. So instead of requiring the coach or the endocrinologist to look through the last 14 days of your continuous glucose monitor tracing, we could just distill that into an insight. And then they can say, oh, you know, when you adjusted that medication, it really looks like you've done a lot better. So we can kind of serve as an extender to the existing clinical workforce who are supporting these patients, which helps it scale. It does help it scale. It's not linear exactly. You know, you don't need one extra coach for every additional number of patients or whatever, but it certainly does help a lot. And I think the other important thing about it is that these technologies enable the experience to be really deeply personalized and to feel very personal, so that the information is customized to that individual, and also they feel that human touch, and that can be done both digitally and with humans. So that's how we think about that.
When you have technology that are changing workflows for physicians, as an example, I would imagine that the amount of continuous glucose monitor data that physicians are seeing, or its distilled version as provided by some summarization software, might be the first time physicians are making decisions with that kind of scale of data. How do you think about any sort of training that the physicians would need as these technologies are enabling new workflows?
That's a really important question and really important perspective that I think is often lost in our narrative about healthcare and healthcare transformation, is the amount of change that is necessary and underway for our clinician workforce, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, everyone really. And we're really focused on that at Verily. It's probably not surprising since I'm a clinician and that's my own particular bias, but I think it's been very much neglected in the national narrative and in ways in which policies have been implemented, actually. So you talk about education. I think that's one dimension of it. I think the fee-for-service model has put most clinicians onto this hamster wheel of, you know, you need to work harder and harder to generate enough revenue. And so that's why they're only spending 8 minutes per patient in a primary care visit and still have 2 hours a night of pajama time on the electronic health record, you know, all those kinds of things. And so there's hardly any additional capacity to learn or to digest or to reflect. And so one of the tasks that we have, one of the challenges that we put to our product development team and to our user experience researchers is to work very closely with clinicians to apply that same design thinking to them. How do we make the right thing the easy thing for patients? Yes, but also for our clinicians. And, you know, one of the earliest experiences that I had in Verily was when our lead user experience researcher, who had actually come from a very senior position in Google to now move into healthcare and work with us, and she spent a day with a whole bunch of physicians in a clinic. And she said, first of all, I don't know how they do what they do. They never seem to go to the bathroom or, you know, have any breaks. And the second thing she said was, they don't even know how to improve their own lives. Like, they're just on such a hamster wheel. They have these computers, but the computers aren't really doing anything to make their lives simpler. It's just like you've taken a paper document and stuck it on a computer screen. You're not using any of the intelligence of the computer to make your lives any easier. So we've actually in Verily built out a new business called Verily Value Suite, which is really all about helping physicians, hospital leaders, other clinicians use this. We use the same kind of AI tools and predictive analytics, you know, the same kind of thinking and the same kind of how do we build user interfaces that make the right thing the easy thing for clinicians now to do with exactly that mindset. And I think, you know, expecting them to kind of study and read and, you know, learn how to do something different just to use your product, that's really not going to work in today's landscape.
I would love to talk more about Verily Value Suite. And also just recently, I guess for our listeners, Verily announced a big 2-year partnership with the Mayo Clinic to help develop decision support tools for clinicians. And I want to start by asking, it does feel like Alphabet's efforts generally, but also specifically Verily's efforts, tend to be more clinician-facing and payer-facing than maybe some of the other big tech efforts in this space, which maybe are arguably more consumer-facing. And I'm curious if you would agree with that, first of all. And second of all, sort of what you think the larger strategy at Verily, at Alphabet, is in one way or another.
Well, in Verily, where I lead health platforms, we really want to make a significant impact on the landscape of healthcare and truly tackle the triple and even quadruple aim. And by focusing on how we can achieve better health and lower costs and better access and greater quality of life for everybody, I think it's important to recognize that we have really an ecosystem of healthcare, that we need products and solutions that can help patients, as we just talked about, through, say, apps, for example, like Onduo, disease management programs. We also need to think very carefully about our clinicians. So we just were talking about Value Suite and the capabilities there. And then I think it's just as important to think about the payer's role. How do we get aligned with the payers, whether they're the employers, the insurance companies, and what's in it for them, and how do we make them successful also in this new model and provide the right tools so that, for example, they can direct patients who need an earlier intervention to the right clinic, where they can approve the right kind of diagnostic test, for example, that's necessary. There's a huge role for the payer to play in this as well. And so at Verily, we have also a stop-loss insurance company called Granular, and that's part of our Verily Health Platforms family of businesses that I'm responsible for. So I think if we can think about it as more of an ecosystem that we're trying to influence rather than just one specific user group, then I think we have a much greater likelihood of having an impact and getting to that better health, which is the target that we're really aiming for.
I think I personally subscribe to this vision that you have of, you know, how can technology disrupt flawed existing business models that currently exist within healthcare? Is that bad? Like, should we not be relying on corporations to do this? Like, should we be trying to tackle this from a regulatory standpoint? Or like, what's the long-term vision? Like, in an ideal world, how does Verily work hand in hand with, and you know, I say Verily, but I mean really all types of commercial efforts work hand in hand with, you know, the existing nightmare, frankly, that is our, you know, US healthcare system, to fix it in a way that's sustainable?
You know, one of the chapters that was the hardest for me to write in the long fix was the last chapter, where I try to roll it together and say, what really needs to happen? You know, here's some exemplary health systems, here's some exemplary community programs, some digital health solutions, and so on. And as I was reflecting on the lessons that I've learned through studying healthcare, I came to the realization that there's a really interesting balance of responsibilities between government and the private sector, particularly in the US, because we have this very unusual model of healthcare here. From the government's perspective, there's a lot that could accelerate the transformation of healthcare. First, this idea of moving from a fee-for-service model to a payment model that can actually create more alignment across everyone, generate more value, you know, really push to better outcomes at lower costs. The Medicare Advantage program that we started this discussion talking about is coming straight from Health and Human Services, from Washington, D.C. And additional payment model changes are really driven by what Medicare does. Medicare, for most of us, is one of our largest payers if we're running a health system. So they're very, very influential. You know, one of the perspectives that I have is in terms of like, how do we use data to do a lot of the things that we're talking about in terms of artificial intelligence and predictive analytics and just providing the best insights and guidance for patients and their providers in terms of their health. And in order for that to happen, we really need to have a much higher level of standards of consistency in our data and the way in which we are able to exchange the data. And that can be very much influenced by government policies. If we have new regulations, for example, about transparency, about how do we really understand pricing in healthcare? How do we understand what insurance benefits are actually available to us and what a hospital or clinic is actually going to bill us and what our out-of-pocket costs are going to be. If the government mandates some transparency in those and more standards in those, then it enables the private sector or the tech sector or third parties to come in and create better tools, you know, to create the Google Maps of healthcare, for example, to create the Yelps and the Amazons and the, you know, where you can actually potentially shop, or you can assess, compare quality of different institutions, where you can use more of that market mindset in healthcare to drive some change. Now, is that going to drive all the change that's necessary? I don't think so, because if you're having crushing chest pain, you're probably not going to go online to try to search what other people said about it. You know, you're just going to get yourself in the ambulance and what it is, what it is. So it's not going to do everything, but it could be helpful also. So there's a lot of ways in which the government sort of putting, you know, leadership really in this country saying, hey, health is really a top priority. This is a strategic imperative for this nation. We've seen it as we've gone through the COVID pandemic, just how vital it is to have a functioning public health and healthcare delivery system. And we are all going to lock arms to accelerate the path there. I think most of us in healthcare know what needs to happen, but there has to be the political will to really take it on, because not all of it is easy.
One frustration for a lot of people trying to affect change in the system has been the lack of data on which to build a lot of these technologies. And data sharing has been one of the big challenges for the system. In terms of incentives for data sharing, there don't seem to be many from the hospital sides. And there are also balances to keep in mind regarding patient privacy and the transparency. How do you think about the ideal fix to this problem?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, I would be a really magical human being. It's such a complicated and very, really vital question. And there's so many different layers to that. So maybe I'll just address one or two parts of it. It's probably the best that I can do for you. First, I think it's really important that we recognize just how important it is to have high quality data that conforms to some kind of data standard. So you can have a lot of different data, but if it's captured in electronic health records in different ways, from how it's captured in your app, from how your insurance company is talking about it. For example, when we were rolling out electronic health records in one hospital that I was working at, I remember the electronic health record vendor was asking me, well, there was one of the medical groups said they wanted to just roll up all the patients who had type 1 diabetes, 2 diabetes, gestational diabetes, hyperthyroidism, or whatever, all under one heading called hormone problems. And was that going to be a problem for us? And I said, well, you might as well not have that question. I mean, let's just forget about even asking that question, because there's no value to that piece of information, right? And that's happening all over the country. We are only starting to see the emergence of real data standards. And, you know, it's really still very early in this process. So very important that we kind of establish data standards and start to expect a higher level of interoperability. Once you do get through the challenges of privacy and whether people are willing to share their data and the purpose of the data, all of those questions are moot if you really have poor quality data that's actually not very useful. So I think that's probably the most important in my mind, is that need for really high quality data and to come up with standards that allow for interoperability. Then we have a lot to discuss in our society about how should data be used, privacy and security challenges. And I think I can say that at Verily, we take this very seriously. We try to be very transparent about uses of data in all of our agreements with our partners. We want to be very open and very clear about how we were using the data only for the intended purposes and how those purposes are intended to benefit patients. Because I think that that's absolutely key. The key is really public trust, and it's very much core to who we are to maintain that public trust.
I want to ask the last question. At the end of each of your chapters in the long fix, you have action items. If you're a patient, Here's what you should think about. If you're a provider, here's what you should think about. So I'd love for you to conclude here with an action item for our listeners here. So if you're a listener of the AI Health Podcast, what should you do?
You should continue listening to this podcast because it's a great series. And I think we need to recognize that healthcare is a problem for this country, and that the legacy that we will leave behind to our children and to future generations very much rests on what we're able to do in the next decade or two about our own healthcare system. I think one of the most important steps that we can each take is to be committed to being willing to change our own behaviors. So I don't remember who said it, but somebody once said, you know, change is hard, you go first. And if we recognize that fixing healthcare in this country is not only a responsibility across the entire population, but there's an individual responsibility that we all bear. And some of that may require us to change our own habits, whether it's making healthier decisions about our lifestyles or our family's lifestyles or how we interact with the healthcare system or how we practice medicine if we're clinicians, whatever it is, we should be willing to make that change.
That's a great note to end on. And Vivian, thank you so, so much for joining us. This was an absolute joy, and we're excited for the next conversation.
Thanks, Adriana. Thanks, Pranav. Really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Dr. Lee for talking to us today. And for the first time this season, thank you, gracias, grazie, for listening. We're your hosts, Pranav and Adriel. And until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee and Mark Robbins. Music by Ethan A. Chi. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know, subscribe to the show, and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or connect with us on Twitter @AI Health Podcast.